Manasu. This morning we return to the meditative cultivation of great loving kindness, and this time we'll attend to the most sublime form of genuine happiness, that arising from wisdom, from insight, from knowledge. Just the opposite, of course, of avidya, of not knowing, of ignorance, and of moha, of delusion. When we speak of wisdom, insight, knowledge, of course, it's very specific. There are so many things we can learn about the nature of reality, and science has just almost unimaginably increased our understanding of what's going on in the natural world. But of course, a lot of what we know about the world, from biology, chemistry, physics, cosmology, geology, and so forth and so on, really doesn't have a whole lot of bearing on our own actual happiness. It's interesting, perhaps. It might impinge or help us avoid hedonic unhappiness and find hedonic happiness. But most of what we know really hasn't had a whole lot of impact in terms of bringing forth genuine happiness. And so this is really the central thrust of the Buddha's teaching. This is why when he was walking through the forest with Ananda, his disciple, his attendant, he said, "My awareness, what I know, is like all the leaves in the forest, and what I'm sharing with you is like with this one leaf. Here's what I find really important for you, and all the other stuff I know, that's kind of like, could be a bit of a distraction." This is not to say that science is a distraction. It is to say that for the cultivation of genuine happiness, there are certain aspects of reality, the knowing of which really does liberate and opens the gateway to genuine happiness. So to give a really short list, to gain really deep, penetrating insight into the reality of impermanence, both coarse and subtle, the reality of our own mortality and that of other people, coarse impermanence, subtle impermanence. That's a game changer, because it just takes all the stuffing out of it. Takes all the power out of attachment, because it doesn't make any sense as you're standing in front of a waterfall to try to grab onto the water and grab as much as you can. It just doesn't make any sense, and the whole of reality is a waterfall. And so there's one. Then a second one, to really gain some experiential insight into what are the true causes of suffering, which we've always wanted to be free of, and what are the true causes of happiness, which we've always wanted. What really is going on here? And that's a really powerful insight. That will be a game changer. That's going to shift radically the whole set of priorities. It has to. Once you say, oh, that's where it comes from, as opposed to all the other ideas we had, right? And then to gain insight into the very absence of there being some autonomous, substantial self, I, me, that's really here, absolutely separate from everything else, and I've really got stuff, like my body, mind, possessions, and so forth. And to see the sheer absence of that is so freeing, it's joyful, it's liberating. And then we can move right on, move into Mahayana territory, move and gain some realization of the... And it's so easy to say, but the absence of inherent nature of all phenomena, not just your body, mind, and you, but of all phenomena, that all are arising independent upon conceptual designation, but empty of any self-nature in and of themselves, they don't exist from their own side. To really even see what that means is so jaw-dropping that he says, are you kidding? And no, check it out. You know, teachings and emptiness, enormously liberating. A special kind of bliss arises from that union of shamatha vipassana in terms of emptiness, realization of emptiness. And then to realize rigpa, pristine awareness, your own ultimate ground of being. Well, that's it. That's the very wellspring, the ultimate wellspring of genuine happiness. So that type of insight, how old the earth is, whether it's 7,000 years old or whether it's 5 billion years old, I'm glad I know. I think the astronomers got that one right, and the creationists, off by several orders of magnitude. Has that contributed to my well-being or happiness? I guess I don't really see it has, although I'm glad to know that, right? And so there we are. There's some aspects of reality, the knowing of which really transforms. But then I come back to an earlier conversation, I believe it was Jane, about, on the one hand, having a conceptual understanding. Do you understand that everything that arises independent upon causes and conditions is momentary? And those other themes, all that is acquired will be lost, everything that's born will die and so forth, is that quite clear? Good, you have a conceptual understanding. How big an impact did that have on your life? Right. and likewise for knowing the true nature, the true origins of happiness and suffering, the nature of non-self, the nature of emptiness, nature of pristine awareness, to have a conceptual understanding, even to believe it. That's very nice. But does that have any more impact in your life than knowing that the planet is 5 billion years old? So the conceptual understanding, okay, it's a step in the right direction, but does that really bring forth genuine happiness? Maybe, a little bit. But then to have some experience of it, and I'm, of course, there is only such a thing as first-person experience of it, that starts to shift things. But experience comes and goes. Then beyond experience, to have a direct realization where you really nail it, you get it, the arrow strikes the target, that has real impact. But of course, we can forget that which we've known. You had an insight, and then other things crowd in a very busy life with many, many stimuli coming in. And that, even of which we had direct insight, can also just kind of fade into a memory, kind of a neat memory. So for any of these insights to really bring about irreversible change, then that final phase in Tibetan Ning Thopa, gaining confidence, where you not only penetrate right through to reality by means of your own immediate experience, but then that insight fuses. It gets into your bloodstream, into your marrow, into your very DNA, all metaphorically speaking, of course, that now it's the way you view reality. It's not something you understood at one time. It's not an experience that came and went. It's not an insight that you have a while back. It is now just so welded into your own being that whatever you look at, whatever you attend to, you're attending it to with that view. That's the view of impermanence. That's just how things appear. That's how you're seeing them. That's how you're viewing them. And that changes everything. Right? And likewise, true sources of suffering and happiness. Likewise, nature of non-self. Likewise, teachings on emptiness. To view all phenomena, actually, not just to believe it or to imagine it, but to actually view, to actually see, perceive all phenomena as empty of inherent nature, all arising no more substantially, no more really out there than a dream. Oh, that changes everything. And of course, ultimately, to view all of reality from the perspective of Rigpa, that's just where you live, that's your home, and you don't leave home. Wherever you go, you're always viewing reality from the perspective of Rigpa. Well, now you found genuine happiness. Ding Thopa, gaining confidence in that. So it's now fused with your very way of viewing yourself, your body, your environment, other people, daytime, nighttime, at all times. You're now viewing reality authentically. That comes in the Eightfold Noble Path. It's called authentic view. And that's what really liberates. That's what really brings genuine happiness in a way that remains, because you're now simply viewing reality in accordance with reality. And therefore, you're also living in accordance with that reality. So, good. Welcome home. That's what Dharma's for. Let's practice. Set your body, speech, and mind at ease. As you settle each one by one, in its natural state. and arouse the luminosity of your own consciousness by arousing your intelligence, your imagination, with the question, why couldn't we all experience the genuine happiness that stems from knowing reality as it is and living in accordance with that reality? After all, the only opposition is unreality, ignorance, and delusion. Why couldn't we find such happiness? And with every out-breath, arouse the yearning. May we all find such genuine happiness, stemming from wisdom. And let your attention rove, or direct it where you will, to individuals, to groups, or in all directions to all sentient beings. With every out-breath, breathe out the light from your heart, or as you wish, simply breathe out. The aspiration, may we all be truly well and happy from the ground up. then from the depths of your own pristine awareness, arouse, if you will, the resolve. May I bring us all to such genuine happiness. Arousing this with every exhalation, as an invitation, as a promise, a commitment. And imagine leading each one, one by one, to such a state of reality-based well-being. And finally, you may call upon the blessings of all the enlightened ones, Bless me that I may carry through with this resolve, that I may be able. Imagine a reality rising up to meet you, with each in-breath drawing in the light of all the enlightenment, with each out-breath breathing out this light of great loving kindness, and imagine, breath by breath, all beings coming to the realization of their innermost heart's desire. Release all appearances and aspirations, and let your awareness rest in its own nature. Lasso. I'd like to pose just for a few minutes some questions that are a variation on that theme. The first one, why couldn't? Why don't we have a very rich, mature science of virtue? Of virtue. Virtues like compassion and so forth, it's only in the last few years that they've even begun to be studied in psychology. Let alone other virtues. It's only in the last few years, and yet psychology has been around for 135 years. What took them so long? All kinds of studies on pathologies and all kinds of studies that are just interesting in terms of cognition and executive control and memory and so forth, but where it really matters to our lives of finding greater happiness, meaning, fulfillment, they've only just begun in the last decade or so to even ask the questions. William James presumed that attention was untrainable more than a century ago. For about a century, nobody was even asking the question, can it be trained? If so, how? And so forth. There's something going on here. And these are not unintelligent people, and they're not devoid of curiosity. Why don't we have a science of genuine happiness? Why don't we have a science that is focused especially on those aspects of reality that liberate? Why don't we? I think those are legitimate questions. Why is almost all of science oriented towards simply the pursuit of knowledge for itself or the pursuit of knowledge for the sake of avoiding hedonic suffering and finding hedonic happiness? Because that's more than 99.99% of the knowledge we have. I invite you just to read scientific journals and see how much has to do with virtue, samadhi, wisdom. Not much. But there's a good reason, I think. And that is we go right back to the origins. Right back there to Galileo and then on to Newton in the late 17th century. They're already Christian. They don't, as scientists, they don't need to ask those questions. They're devout Christians. They're trusting in Jesus, the significance of his dying on the cross, the redemption, the resurrection, all of this. And so as far as they're concerned, those questions have been answered. The nature of virtue, we don't need a science of virtue. That's what the biblical tradition is for. We already have it. And likewise, genuine happiness. That's called salvation. And we already have that. And we know how. And, especially from the rise of the Protestant Reformation, it's come by belief, by faith, by following as well as we can the teachings of the Bible. But that's not enough. But really, it's faith. It's a free gift. And so those questions about virtue and about genuine happiness, namely salvation, those are answered. And what wisdom? Well, we don't really need that much wisdom. We have to have faith and belief. Humility, piety, that's what gets you there, not knowledge. We're not Gnostics, after all. Gnostics, we wiped them out back in the 4th century, 5th century. So no, knowledge is not the path to salvation. Virtue, belief, faith, receiving grace, that's the path. And so pretty much for all three, for ethics, virtue, for genuine happiness, for wisdom, that was taken care of. And so what's left over is understanding the natural world and attending to our hedonic needs. And science has done a very good job at that. Right? There was just a little problem, and that insofar as Judaism and Christianity are not only telling us about values and about salvation and about nature of God, but also making references to the planet and species, they got some pretty important points wrong, like the 7,000-year-old planet, species that don't mutate, they don't change, they just got onto the ark and then they got off. You know, so there are some stories there that just got discredited. In fact, a number of points just got discredited when they tried to make truth claims, and then the scientists got really good at it and said, well, your truth claim is a false claim. And that, in the minds, especially by the time we get to the mid-19th century, the time of Darwin, the age of the earth and so forth, and then Darwin's really his knockout punch, that we are just an animal species that evolved together with all the other animals, and if all the other animals don't have immortal souls, why do you think we do? Or do they have all immortal souls? And that was a track they didn't follow. So if we are really animals, then okay, we're all together in this. We either all have immortal souls or none of us do, and we're going for the latter. And now Christianity is completely discredited. If that's true, then its most central premises, salvation itself, is now shot. It's a mortal wound. Because if we go back, even in the contemplative tradition of Christianity, back to one of its greatest proponents, St. Augustine, and this view ran through pretty much all of the Western Christian tradition from the 4th, 5th century onwards, and that is the contemplative life is to be begun in this life, but you reach its culmination, its fulfillment, only in the afterlife. We can only begin it here. But the real fruit after you're dead, which means you can't report on it. Quite interesting in that, and that assumption pretty much ran through all of Western mystical tradition. An interesting point here is when we look at them, and I did, this was a major part of my dissertation when I was a graduate student, was looking into the issue, when you come to your highest realization, and this is Augustine, this is mainstream contemplatives within the Western Christian tradition, and the Eastern, the Greek Orthodox, when you come to the highest realization, that direct face-to-face encounter with the changeless light, a direct realization, a knowing of God, not just belief, but a knowing, how long can you sustain that view? How long can you sustain that direct vision of this changeless light, which is the ultimate reality? Half an hour. That was the very broad consensus. Half an hour, and then the contemplative after contemplative over the century said, when you rise to that highest pinnacle of contemplative insight, after some time, as if you're just coming too close to the sun, your soul can't bear it, and you fall back. And as you fall back, there's kind of a sadness that you couldn't stay. And then you're back into more mundane view. So it's something you touch, but then you have to fall back. So I got very intrigued about that because I did actually two dissertations when I was at Stanford, one on shamatha and one that dealt a lot with this kind of thing. And so I really checked. Is there any clear evidence in the whole contemplative literature of Christianity that clearly indicates they actually achieve shamatha? And I spoke with a very, very experienced contemplative from the Greek Orthodox tradition about this. And I asked him, because he's really a scholar. I mean, I just dabble in that area. And I asked him, do you see? I mean, I would love to see this. Can you point where somebody's actually gotten to, you know, have achieved shamatha, and they can meditate for 4 hours, 8 hours, 12 hours straight, effortlessly, no laxity, no excitation. Did you get accounts there? Are the people who've achieved that? He said, I've not seen it. So what I see doesn't really matter. But he's really he's a scholar as well as a solo hermit living out in Wales. He's really, really very, quite an extraordinary individual. But he said, I've not seen that. So if he's not seen it, it may be that they actually didn't achieve shamatha. At the same time, when I read the writings of these great mystics like John Skorice Aryujana, 8th century, and Meister Eckhart, and then later Nicholas Cusa, and so forth, let alone the early Desert Fathers and the writings of the great adepts in the Greek Orthodox tradition, to my mind, this is my opinion, I think they had incredibly profound insights. I really do. I think they struck right down to the ground, right down to pristine awareness. That's my impression. I see the descriptions and so forth, and wow, of course you couch this in a theistic context. Of course you would. But when you're coming right from your experiences, like, really, boy, that's deep. It looks to me like, how can you tell the difference between that and Dzogchen? That's just my view. But then, if we come back to the issue, understanding, yes. Experience, yes. Insight, I suspect so. What about that fourth one? Ding topa. Did you gain confidence? Were you able to bring a mind that was so well honed, refined, balanced, and tuned that when you ascended to the pinnacle of insight in your own tradition, you were able to sustain it for as long as you wish so that it actually completely melds with your way of viewing reality and you're never separated? That was Augustine's aspiration. It's quite interesting because he was a Manichaean before he became a Christian. And his aspiration was to have this direct knowledge of God and then to sustain it at all times. And by his own account, he failed. He couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. And then I look in his writings, I see no evidence of him or anybody else of his era achieving shamatha. This is the point in Buddhism. Not just to gain insight, but to so fuse it, your shamatha with your vipassana, that you gain confidence. So you don't just be introduced to reality and then back off. You be introduced to reality and you become reality. You just don't get separated. So could we have, this is now William James, I find this so fascinating, and not just intriguing, but so important. That's just my perspective. But could we have what this extraordinary visionary William James proposed as a science of religions? And this is not just religious studies. I have a PhD in that. That's not a science of religions, even though it's called Religionswissenschaft auf Deutsch. Okay, but that's not what William James is getting at. We just get a bunch of scholars reading about each other's books. That's not what he is talking about. He's talking about having great adepts, I mean really accomplished adepts who are Taoist, who are Hindu, who are Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, and so forth. And then having them report on their discoveries and the methods for gaining the discoveries and seeing whether those discoveries are replicable. And then getting together and saying, all right, from our laboratories, this is what we discovered. And this is our conceptual framework. Four Noble Truths, oh yeah, ours is the Trinity and the Bible, the New Testament. Oh yeah, ours is the Jewish Bible. Oh, ours is the, Tao Te Ching or whatever. So we're coming from different starting points, which is really cool. Then, everybody's not being indoctrinated in the same way, just brainwashed to realize the same thing. No, they're coming from very different vantage points. Theistic, monotheistic, polytheistic, non-theistic, And then what do you call it? Taoism? I'm not quite sure. But there it is. But then coming together, like scientists coming together, at a convention like the Society for Neuroscience, and say, this is what we in our hermitage, in our contemplative observatory, we Taoists, and we Hindus, and we Theravadins, and we Dzogchenpas, and we Vajrayana practitioners, and we Chan adepts, out in China. This is what we've discovered. And then getting them together and say, okay, let's sift through this. Is there any common ground, or are we all just going off in different directions? And having an empirical science of contemplative insight, in other words, a contemplative science. Now, that would be pretty choice. That's what he envisioned. Never happened. Never happened. It's just too cool. The 20th century says, that's just way too cool for us. Sorry, we're not up to it. Right? But now let's make it even richer. So-called religious people, or people devoted to a contemplative path. We're not the only ones interested in the nature of consciousness, nature of genuine happiness, nature of virtue and ethics. We're not the only ones. We have no monopoly. A lot of people who don't count themselves as religious in any way, they're equally interested. And now more and more scientists, boy, finally in the last 10, 20 years, now consciousness has become a legitimate topic for study in neuroscience and psychology. For a long time, it was not. Don't even ask the question. Not in the laboratory anyway. So then we could actually enrich this to invite scientists and, of course, philosophers. Finally give them some methodology. They can put their theories to the test. Come on, philosophers. Come in with your bright ideas. We'll give you some bright methods. And have a celebration of philosophers from multiple schools coming in, scientists, physicists, neuroscientists, psychologists, contemplative different traditions, and say, look, what we're after here is human flourishing. We've always been interested, all of us, and now let's get it together. For the first time in recorded history, let's get it together. And no winners and losers here. When we find something that's true, then we all win. And when we recognize that any of our assumptions, whether they're Buddhist assumptions, materialistic assumptions, Christian assumptions, whenever we find that any of our beliefs or assumptions can be demonstrated to be false through first-person or third-person experience, that's replicable, sophisticated, rigorous, then we all win. Because who wants to go through life carrying false beliefs? That doesn't make any sense. even if they're kind of comforting and you're used to them, it's still like dirty laundry. I mean, it would be really nice to be free of it. So that would be quite something. And all the pieces are there. Sometimes if I seem a little bit impatient, it's because I am. Because I see all the pieces. I see all the pieces are there. Are there Taoist adepts and Hindu adepts, Buddhist, Christian, and so forth? Yes. Are there scientists who are open-minded, willing to reassess their own assumptions, question materialism, not just throw it out, but question it? Are there philosophers who are really interested in this, to actually experience for themselves true lovers of wisdom, philosophia? The answer is yes. So come on, I'm getting old here. Why are we not getting it together? Is there anything more important than this for all of humanity? Is there anything more important than this, that we bring it all together so that our ethics is based in empirical truth, experience, reality, and not simply in this belief system and that belief system and so forth, even though the belief system may be very useful and even true? A science of ethics, a science of samadhi, a science of cultivating absolutely exceptional health, mental health, balance, clarity, intelligence, and so forth. And then a science of contemplative inquiry that would work hand in hand with scientific and philosophical inquiry, that we can all be cross-pollinating in a garden festival of the pursuit of truth. So that's my dream. That's my expression of great loving kindness, insofar as I have even a facsimile. But the potentials are enormous, and we have all the pieces together. And this isn't even very expensive. Not nearly expensive as making weapons of mass destruction. Now that's costly. You know, this is relatively cheap. So, hello everybody. Let's get it on. Enjoy.